Welcome to ITE 1, Module 3, probably Part 1, because we never get through Module 3 in one go. All right, before we start, does anyone have any questions, comments, concerns about labs, or anything like that?
I do.
Okay, what is your question?
I was going through my labs for Chapter 3, and some of those labs don't have anything that you write in. They're just basically follow the procedure and you're at the end of the lab. How do we handle that with you?
Well, you read it and then you go on with your life.
You also listen to the assembly-disassembly recording that will be posted soon.
If you're not doing it on
your own. Yeah, if you're not actually doing the work yourself, you listen to the assembly-disassembly recording and there will be a new one that is coming up. And that will be up in a day or two once I edit the big pauses out where everybody's going, because otherwise it's an hour and 45 minutes long, and you guys don't need that.
It is one long recording. You guys, please read them.
Cherry, I can't check. Heard, by the way.
Yeah.
Oh, there we go.
What?
Yes, if you were meant to be heard.
Of course I'm meant to be heard. La 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 la, you can hear me. No.
Okay, so I can't actually check if you've done them, but honestly, it is to your advantage to read through.
Yeah, you sort of weren't. I think that was just like a massive delay. It was quite odd because I could hear your echo through Grace, but then.
Yeah, the ping's showing 77, so let's move on. Sorry about that.
Alright. So, yeah, I can't check your labs to see if you've done them, but it is in your best interest to just read through those labs so that you know what's going on and see the Cisco procedure for how to do this stuff. So, yep, you read them, you're done. That's all you have to do. You'll see more of those types of labs in Module 5, and you'll be very grateful that you don't have to do anything with them because you have so many labs in Module 5, it isn't funny. I think Luke counted once, and I don't remember the number he came up with.
I believe it was 20. It was 20-something, anyway.
Yeah, so you're only doing half of, you're doing less than half of those labs.
Other, like the Vista ones, but yeah, I think it was 22 or 28 or something.
Yeah, you're doing less than half of those labs, so don't panic too much. Mm-hmm. Alright, so, let's, any other questions on labs or anything before I start?
We hear there's a cooperative recording venture possibly happening this weekend for the Canadians. If it does happen, please record it. And if it's good enough, which I'm sure it will be, it will go up on the site with all the other ones.
It could be. It sounds like it'll be lots of fun. It'll be cool.
We'll see if it happens or not. There's a crisis in Brian's family, so we're just going to see what's going on.
Okay.
Could push it back a week.
No, we're good. We're good if I don't have to go to a funeral. I think I don't, because I haven't done the autopsy and all that good stuff. So I think we're good for Saturday.
Ah.
Oh, good.
Well, keep me posted. Let me know if it doesn't happen. And, yeah. All right. Any other questions on labs or anything of that nature? Alrighty then. One other announcement besides, for those on the recording, we already spoke about this. Daylight savings time comes into effect next week. Lecture will be an hour later if you're on daylight savings time and change. If you are not, it is the same time for you. Perth does not have daylight savings time, so we don't move, but you Americans do. So it'll be 9 o'clock Eastern for everybody from now on
some parts
if you're
that
in
don't.
America.
But
also,
if you are in a part that you'll know...
You'll know.
You'll either know whether you do or you don't, because this happens every year. So.
Also, keep in mind that if you are an Eastern Stater, you will also move an hour forward. You'll be 3 hours ahead of Perth, which means the lectures will start at midday instead of 11. So try not to eat your meat pie too
loudly. No, we move back.
Does Australia come forward? They move back.
We move back, and I'm not sure when they move.
Neither am I. It's in my time zone database, but I can't be bothered looking it up.
It's Americans. We move later.
The actual daylight savings ends for Melbourne and New South Wales soon, and they will actually move an hour closer to us. So they will start at 11 instead of 12.
That'll be fine.
And you, Luke, will move back towards us as well, so you'll be 4 hours.
Yeah, but I don't know when that happens, though. I'll need to find the radio.
There are websites that will tell you. There's government websites that tell you.
Time and date will tell. Time and date can probably tell you.
Yeah, I don't think it's this weekend, because Jonathan Mosen would have been squawking about it.
Yeah, no, I don't think it's this weekend either. I haven't heard anything.
Alright, I think you're okay then.
Kylie will probably notify for you anyway.
Okay, right. Any questions on daylight savings from anyone?
As soon as I can get a time and date link, I will. I've got the message composed, and
you just have to redo it.
I just have to figure out how to do a time and date link, and then I'll try and put it.
It's easy,
ASAP. Yeah,
Daylight savings time is Saturday night here in the States.
At 2 a.m. or whatever. It's like Sunday at 2 a.m. or something.
Yep, something ridiculous. Okay, so the third and final announcement I have is course fees are due. If you haven't paid your course fees, you should write me an email with maybe why, and we can sort it out. Otherwise, you should probably pay them and write me with an email with the fact that you did. And if we've already talked and you do not have to pay course fees because you have gotten waiver because of extenuating circumstances, then you don't need to talk to me because I know already.
And if you have extenuating circumstances and you haven't told her, you need to tell her. So get on with that. Also, keep in mind that we will, if we haven't heard from you and you don't talk to us within a quite significant amount of time, so we're looking 2, 3, 4 weeks, if you don't communicate with us and you haven't paid, you will be suspended. This is fair warning.
And we will contact you personally if that is going to happen. So you're not just suddenly going to be knocked off of the course. You will get an email from me, and if you don't respond to that, probably a phone call. I think most people have paid, so it's not a big deal.
So you also, need to be contacted if...
What?
You need to be contacted if a person's already paid, or you just... That's okay.
That's okay. That's okay. If you haven't paid and you do, I need to be contacted.
It's cutting down the number of people we need to chase. The other thing is that if we are looking at rejigging the PayPal stuff on the main website to make it easier, we do apologize for the challenge that the current one is. However, we don't have access to the account, so we can't regenerate the JavaScript until early next week.
Unless we find Kieran.
No, he doesn't have the creds. I already asked him in the library. No go.
How does it need to be easier?
Well, the forms are mislabeled. The first field is actually a comment field where it actually says an amount when it shouldn't. And we can probably make it so that you can pick the courses you're doing from drop-down boxes and check the I've got a scholarship box and all that sort of fun stuff, and it will become really easy.
Oh, that's cool.
Yeah. All right. Any other questions on how to pay course fees? Anything about course fees? You don't have to ask now, but you can. Okay, cool. Let's start today's lecture. So last week, Sean talked about tools, personal safety, and how to take apart a computer. Today, we're going to be talking about assembling a computer. When assembling a computer, it's important to stay organized and have a plan as to which order you will install components. Learning how to disassemble a computer takes practice. For example, the first time I installed a stick of RAM, it took me 90 minutes. Now it takes me about 30 seconds on a good day, unless I'm super uncoordinated, which happens, then it can take a while. Before we even think about assembling our computer, we need to prepare the workspace. Make sure you have good lighting, ventilation, and comfortable temperature.
Handy point. Have a flashlight if you've got sighted help, because they won't bring one.
Carrie has a good story about the whole have good lighting. And I should probably tell it, because it's just hilarious.
Oh, yes. Now, we had a situation. It's not quite IT related, but we had a situation out in our little country town where the power went out. And my mother, who wasn't thinking because of the lights just went out, went, "Stay where you are, there's no light, I'll go get the candles." I'm like, "No, Mum, how about you stay where you are and I'll go get the candles because this darkness isn't bothering me at all." And she's like, oh, sorry, son, I forgot about that.
It was like that at my house. It was always, "Sean, go get your sister."
It was great. Yeah, that's funny. At least they understood. It was great, like, when I was at a new place, my grandma goes, "Okay, you've got to know, you know, about the bathroom. Here's the fan switch and here's the light switch." I go, "I don't need the light switch, thank you." The fact that you're putting my hand on it should kind of give you the clue.
That was IT related because Carrie had a computer part in the middle of the floor and just kind of kept working on it. Another great story that isn't IT related about lights was I was up in school going pedaling away on my exercise bike during gym class. Everybody else is playing volleyball, and all of a sudden I hear this horrible screaming coming from the gym. And I'm asking my vision aid, "Oh my gosh, we should probably go see what's happening. It's something horrible." She's like, no, the lights just went out. So, pretty funny. So, we may not need the most lighted space unless we have sighted help. In which case, we have to be cognizant.
We have a similar thing, wasn't I? Like, showing you where the light switches were in this apartment and stuff, I'm like...
Oh, you were!
I think the other thing is that it is important to have a flashlight, and it's important to have batteries for that flashlight that work, because if you do have sighted people coming over, they may need the lights. Don't be like one of my blind friends that removes all of the light bulbs from his house so that sighted people can't turn the lights on. That's being a bit nasty. But do have batteries, and may I recommend some rechargeable Vata ready to use or Enerloop ones that will hold their charge once you've topped them up. That way you're not buying, like, piles of green cells. Piles of...
Why not? It's payback for those hybrid cars.
Ah, well. Let's not go there.
Who does that?
I'd rather not name and shame on lecture.
Oh, that one. Sure enough, nobody we know, really.
Right. I know him painfully well, yeah. But he takes all of the light bulbs out. Whereas Will Taylor has a better solution. He actually just has a breaker switch in the hall that he can just flick up and it'll turn the whole lighting circuit off, which is a far nicer solution.
Now that's what I'd want.
That's what I want, yeah.
I just got light detector on my iPod, speaking of
isn't
lights
it cool?
and things. Yeah. Oh, you know what? You know what sounds really weird? I did this. Put it up to a bare light bulb. We've got some light bulbs hanging around, or just like hanging out around the mirror, and it goes. It's like really ear hurting. It's great.
Light detector, 99 cents at the App Store. It's pretty cool, and it's will tell you whether
it's
your iPhone thing is receiving light.
All right. Now we're going to talk about the ideal workbench, and then we're going to laugh because. You know what? I've never had the pleasure of working on an ideal workbench. But an ideal workbench is accessible from all sides and has an anti-static mat on both the table and under your feet. Yeah. Anyway, never actually gotten to use one. Keep your space and yourself organized. Not something we did in our recording, and we have all sorts of interesting screws in our computer now. Basically, because we only had one cup to drop everything into, and yeah. Use little containers, cups, or bowls to keep track of screws and small components. for me, when I'm doing my own stuff, I will place the different cups and stuff in near different things, so then I know what they are. If you have any sight, you can label them with tape, or something of that nature. You can also use Braille labeling tape if you're rich and have some to waste. Make sure you put components in a safe place where you won't knock them on the floor. If you will be reusing the components, put them in an anti-static bag. Use a good toolbox to organize your tools. Cases come in many form factors. What does a case's form factor refer to?
Shape and size.
Size and shape.
Size and shape.
Good job, guys. Size and shape. All right. And I think for this chapter, we're going to try something a little different. So if everybody could get into chat, that would be really good. And what we're going to do is we're going to have people type their names into chat when they want to chime in with something. That way, I will actually be able to call on you, and we'll be able to keep track of who has answered and take you out of the running for answering questions for a little while, because there are lots of different questions in this chapter. Is that all right with everyone?
Well, too bad if it's not, because it means we're all orderly. But we love having you all talk. It's just a bit much
Harry,
when everybody talks.
You might want to be in
chat. I will be in a second. I'm currently getting a time and date link for Sean, so...
And Tom, you want to put yourself into chat as well.
I was trying to figure it out.
No, you want the fixed world time clock. I'm just trying to find where
okay,
that link is.
Okay, that's cool. Oh, I can find it. I saw it. I just didn't know that.
That's the one you want. Fixed world time clock, and then set it for Perth time at 9 a.m. on the particular date, and then go make link and then just shorten.
Awesome. All right, so that chat window, we'll just live in there, and we will have you type in your name when you want to answer. All right. What are three components which need to be of the same form factor? All right, Dana, go. Yep. Anyone else have... not CPU, I'm sorry.
You said CPU.
No, CPU, so I'm sorry. Gonna... No, CPU is incorrect. Oh. Aiden?
That would be the case, motherboard, and power supply, I think?
That's right. That's absolutely right. So case, motherboard, power supply must be the same form factor. Dana is thinking of slot type, which is motherboard, CPU, and heat sink/fan assembly. So good job, Aiden. All right. Our cases can open in many different ways. They can either use screws or be screwless and have toolless cases where you have the little clips or tabs that you use to open them up. Now, these can be the hardest cases to open because you have to figure out how to open them. With the ones with screws, you can usually find the screws and see how to take them off. For my cases, I personally use thumb screws, which are screws with large heads that you can remove without a screwdriver, unless somebody has screwed them in unbelievably tight, in which case you need a big Phillips head screwdriver usually to take them out. here are some examples of ways that cases can be opened. The computer case cover can be removed in one piece. The top and side panels of the case can be removed. Sometimes you're going to have to take the top of the case off before you remove your side panels. The most common design is the ones where the two sides come off and you don't actually have to remove the top. So you just have the two big side panels that you unscrew and pull off. If you are unsure about how your case opens, check its manual or the manufacturer's website, and you'll probably be able to find out. Or you can Google how to open up this type of computer, and someone will have probably written about how we do that.
Except when you buy a case where the manual is actually inside it. And I've seen that more often than not, unfortunately.
Oh dear. any questions on cases? And how to open them and deal with them? Not necessarily.
You might need a manual to open the case if it's, I mean...
You might, depending on it. If it's just one of the normal cases, I don't usually need a manual to open it because there are four screws. They're thumb screws, and I just undo them and pull off the sides.
However,
if you've got like a Dell Optiplex or something.
Well, yeah, then you're going to need a whole course on how to open that case.
We actually had one that had the screws recessed in behind the front panel, so you actually had to pull off the front panel, and then you could get at the screws. And we left one of our poor IT friends sitting in front of it for 15 minutes until his blood pressure was dangerously high before we walked over and popped the front panel off and said, "There you go, Aaron. This is how you open it up." It was fun for all concerned.
The one good thing I like is that Lovely. One good thing I love about there are screwless cases, and they have nice little latches that you just pull up. My old computer that I toasted was one of those.
I'm sort of a bit sort of two-sided on screwless cases. Whilst screwless cases make it easy to pop the sides and stuff off, I've found that some of the stuff that retains the hard drives in screwless cases isn't that brilliant. And you can find that hopefully the good screwless cases also have capacity for screws which will actually hold the drives in better than those little foldy clippy things.
Okay, I never was brave enough to examine the mountings for the hard drive in there. I just pulled the RAM out and that was about as far as I got.
Can you guys still hear me or have we lost our internet connection?
You're back now.
Oh, I'm back.
It went away for a minute.
Okay, mine kept
Grace
recording, so it
keeps
looks like
going in and out.
Yeah, strange.
Can anyone hear me?
We can now.
Yep.
Yes.
Yep.
Oh, she can't hear anyone else.
I got a comment while we're waiting on her.
Yeah, by all means, comment away.
I actually have a desktop that I'm using as my Linux box right now, and it's a screwless case. You just pop the top and the sides are all one piece, and the tabs at the back of it, you just pop them off. Slide the thing forward, and then it's got the little mounting for the floppy, the hard drive, and I put a CD-ROM in there, and it's actually pretty good. Obviously, everything's screwed in, and you just flip the thing over, and you can get access to the hard drive and the motherboard and everything else like that. So that actually works out quite nicely.
Are you back? You joined the channel now, Grace.
Sorry,
is Grace on here?
Not now.
Not yet.
Anyone else?
Oh, there we go, I can hear.
I can't.
Oh, now I can. There we go.
Did you have a box checked that wouldn't let you?
Yeah, somehow I did.
It's easy to accidentally... It highlights that box by default, and if you dack the space bar, it'll shut everybody down, and you don't know what happens until later, and then you go, ah, oh, mute incoming audio was checked. Don't I look clever? I've done it too.
Oh, yeah. No, I did get booted off the server at one point, and I was trying to reconnect, and something must have just... messed up epically.
Yeah, it just
seemed like times actually.
Yeah, it was beautiful. My wireless was on, so I think the router might have had a flaky moment, so I turned the wireless off and there we go.
Actually, sorry, I couldn't speak all along because accidentally I muted the microphone.
Oh, well, good, we checked.
Dana, if you've got any more volume, if you can wind that up, that'd be good. If you don't, we'll just tolerate. You're just a bit quiet, that's all.
All right. Are we done with cases? Any more comments or questions on cases?
Get one that doesn't have sharp sides. Go ahead, Luke.
Something I wanted to say, it's not so much case-related, but talking about the drive mountings. When me and Grace pulled a box apart, it did this... It was a desktop thing. It did this really weird thing where the drive bays actually flipped up and over. All the drives, the hard drive, the CD drive, everything. It was really odd because all the cables were still connected and stuff, and we're trying to work out, because we wanted to get the power supply out, and we had to pull everything else out first.
That's better.
And we had to pull the power supply out first, and we're going, how the hell do we get these drives out? And because there just wasn't any room, basically. And I think Grace eventually found there was some little catchy, weird thing.
Yeah, it swung out or something. It was really strange.
I can find it if I look at the box, but I still don't actually know, you know, like what the catch is that does it or where it is or whatever. And these things, this whole thing just went up and over. It was like, it was hinged. It was very, very odd, and it actually flipped, you know, outside the main case. And of course, as soon as it did this, everything suddenly came out colossally and started landing on everything and pulling cables and stuff. And I'm just being, no, Grace, just stop. And she's going, why? What's it doing? I'm going, look at that. And it was very, very weird because neither of us were expecting it to do anything like what it ended up doing.
It's not like Grace to go and press all the buttons and pull and twist and poke things to see what happens. It's not her at all.
No, it wasn't so much that she was doing that. It's just that she found the catch and goes, oh, sweet, it hinges and grabbed it. And
I didn't expect it to go like that.
Fell out
I didn't
the
expect
opposite
it to do what
bay,
it did.
Yeah.
I guess that case. Sorry, it's Aiden. I guess that case could be marketed for ease of disassembly. We'll conveniently put all the stuff outside the case for you. Boing.
It did.
We have a pending Brian, by the way.
Yep, Brian. Brian, what did you want to say?
Just my same story. Be careful of cases that have weird designs, like a bar that runs from the front to the back on the left side. It was a Cooler Master, which I'm surprised because I had other ones, and it's a very fancy one with LEDs inside and a see-through side. But I couldn't remove the power supply without taking out the motherboard, which I eventually didn't do. I used a very un-Cisco-like procedure, and a hacksaw does wonders, and the bar went away.
Fair enough. That'll do it.
Now the Panasonics are ringing. The only problem I could see with doing that, and it may not have been a problem for Brian, but when you actually take those bars out, you will actually find that it actually does decrease case stability and you may get warp in the metal frame. But I'm sure that didn't happen to Brian. Okay. Aiden, I think, wanted to say something. No, it was Dina.
I just said what? Use a hacksaw? Yeah, Dina.
Yeah, I've had a case where I had to take the whole base plate that the motherboard actually sat on to actually get to everything else.
Now that would be annoying.
Yep, someone's microphone's really got a weird noise.
Yeah, it was making a fuzz buzzing noise, but it stopped now.
Oh, that's special. Okay. Alright, the next thing we're going to talk about is installing the power supply. The power supply is a big, heavy box that can usually only be installed one way. Power supplies have fans that vibrate and may shake screws loose, so you need to make sure that you use all of the screws that come with your power supply and are meant to be installed in there, because some of the power supplies helpfully give you a couple extra screws if you buy the really fancy ones. Usually they'll have 4 or 6 screws, so you want to put them all in, and you want to tighten them well. To install a power supply, you're going to insert the power supply into the case, align the holes in the power supply with the holes in the case, secure the power supply to the case using the proper screws, tighten them up, there you go, it's in. Any questions on installing power supplies?
Just an interesting point. If you've got, say, 4 screws in a square, for instance, or even if you've got 3 in a triangle, I don't know, I'm one of these people, I've always put the, for instance, the 2 top ones in first and then move down. But if you actually put the top one in and then put the bottom one in next, or the diagonally opposite one, you can actually support it both ways rather than just one, which can be a good thing.
Yeah, because then it won't move on you.
It's advisable to do that. That's the same if anybody's changed the tire on a car. It stops too much stress being put on the particular bolts, which is why you put the diagonally opposite ones in first, because it actually shores it up better. It also means that if you put the top right and the bottom left in, or whatever, it will actually stop the supply from swinging backwards and forwards. If you put the top two in, then the bottom of the power supply can swing out and in, and that can be catastrophic sometimes.
All right. Now, the next thing we are going to do is work on the motherboard. We're going to attach the CPU, heatsink, and the RAM to the motherboard. Cisco recommends installing the CPU, heatsink, and RAM before installing the motherboard in the case, because if you do this while it's in the case, you can put stress on the motherboard. of course, if you're actually working on a computer that has already been built, and replacing RAM or something like that, you're not going to take the motherboard all the way out of the case and reinstall it, because that's just silly. But
however, if you do this, you do run the risk of actually bending the board back against the case, and if you do that, and I have seen this happen, and then you power it up, you let the smoke out.
So be careful. I have many times installed RAM in a board that's in a case, and I've not had this happen to me yet, but, before touching, go ahead, Pat.
What does a processor feel like? I can put my hands around the the CPU fan and catch the understanding of that shape, but what does the processor actually feel like?
It's a little about a quarter inch wide, quarter inch deep, about an inch square, light little chip with either pins on the bottom of it, all sorts of little pins, or holes on the bottom of it, and the pins are in the actual slot. So it's very light. Some of the older ones are very light. The newer ones are actually quite a bit heavier because they have a lot more to them. They can fit in the, your processor can fit in the palm of your hand. It's very small.
And is it according to what the motherboard is, whether it's Intel or AMD, of how you
That's
put
correct.
It in there?
No. they're all going to be ZIF slots now. So you're going to line them up with the cutoff corners lined up together, and it'll just drop in.
Pretty like, much like the memory does.
No, easier than the memory does.
Well, that's debatable, but it should be. Unless you're installing old processors, which is where you need you and six mates to lean on the screwdriver to actually put the fan clip down. And we're hoping you're working on modern stuff, because the old stuff was very difficult to get those retention mechanisms to grab.
It just drops in. The RAM you've got to actually push. This you don't put any pressure on, because it just drops in and you use the lever to apply the pressure.
So that would mean, too, there's no click, or there's no...
There's no click.
There's nothing to tell that it's actually seated there. It just sort of...
You will feel it.
And that's the end of it.
You'll know if it is seated in. It will fall in. It will just drop into that slot. Into the socket.
If it's not in correctly, you will not be able to swing the lever. That is always a good hint that you have not socketed in properly. If you can't swing the lever easily, and the lever starts making noises, I'd be stopping at that point and finding out what you actually did wrong before you crunch it.
When you're touching a CPU, you need to make sure you have very clean and dry hands. CPUs are incredibly sensitive. When handling the CPU, always wear an anti-static wrist strap, and if possible, work on an anti-static mat. Try not to touch the bottom of the CPU, because this is where the contacts are located, and you could get them dirty. As blind people, it might not be quite possible for you not to touch those bits, but please try not to. If you're installing a used CPU, you need to clean the top with isopropyl alcohol to remove the thermal compound and apply a fresh layer. You want a very thin layer that covers the entire CPU. Now, most CPUs these days come with this on, and you just pull off a little bit of film and it's already there, so don't touch the top. You just want to grab it around the very edges so you don't get your finger in the heat compound. Does anyone remember what type of locking mechanism is used to secure CPUs in modern computers? Go ahead, Brad.
There's a lever and a plate.
Right, what's it called?
I don't see.
All right, Rich, go ahead.
A load lever?
It is. The locking mechanism is actually called a ZIF socket for zero... insertion force. You do not
I thought you were talking about just the locking mechanism. I didn't realize
that is what
the
locking
slot,
mechanism. No, that's what the locking mechanism is called and the way it works. So the mechanism and the what is used is called a zero insertion force slot or socket. I'm sorry. And that means you do not have to press anything down. The load lever that you pull up does that for you. Before installing the CPU, make sure you know how the ZIF socket works. So take that lever up and down, give it a couple test goes to make sure you know how it's going to work. All right, to install this, line up pin 1 with pin 1 on the motherboard. For us, this means line up the cutoff corners on the CPU and the one on the motherboard. It will just fall into place once you've done that. If it doesn't, you've probably done it wrong. then what we're going to do is
Is it worth mentioning the lever? Have you said the lever's got to be open?
You do have to pull the lever, have the lever up. So, you're going to close the CPU load lever to ensure that it is in place. You're going to move it down, so the lever is going to be straight up, and you're going to push it down, and it's going to go underneath a little tab so that it stays down, if your motherboard has the little tab on it. Then, if you haven't done this already, you're going to apply a small, thin layer of thermal compound in a thin, even layer. Follow the application instructions provided by the manufacturer to make sure you've done it correctly. You can either do this by possibly putting a little tiny bit on the heatsink and putting it down on top of the CPU, or you can have a friendly neighborhood-sided person do it for you, because it is kind of tricky to do. Or you just buy a CPU that already has it done. Go ahead, Pat.
What does the top of the CPU feel like? Is it a solid, like, metal piece across there, or is it open?
Yeah, it's just basically a smooth metal plate.
You can actually see the transistors. So the new ones aren't actually a metal plate. They're actually, you can actually see the top grid of the transistors, and it's actually transparent. You can actually, if you're sighted, you can actually see it. But it is flat, and that's about an inch square.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Any other questions on installing the CPU? Does kind of. Some of the newer ones do. But it isn't.
In chat they said it feels like glass.
Alright, now we're going to go on to the heat sink slash fan assembly. This is a two-part cooling device. The heatsink draws heat away from the CPU, and the fan moves the heat away from the heatsink. This usually has a 3-pin power connector that attaches to the motherboard. What do we need to do if we're reusing a heatsink slash fan assembly? Does anybody know?
Apply the thermal compound and make sure the fan's working properly and balanced. Sorry, I should have said my name. It's Aiden.
No, actually, you're incorrect. Because if we apply more thermal compound, then it won't bond right.
Just a point. Well, because we've got two Bryans, feel free to just type your last name in, because it'll be quicker.
Just type your last name.
And you're up, Mr. Shaw.
And you're up, Brian.
If you're reusing it, you want to clean it.
Yes, you want to take that isopropyl alcohol and, just like you've done to your used CPU, clean off the excess thermal compound so that you can bond it to the new CPU that already has the fresh layer of thermal compound on it. You only want to put thermal compound on one component. You don't need two layers. So you either do the heatsink slash fan assembly or the CPU. You do not do both. So, as a blind person, you can put a little tiny dot in the middle of the heatsink, and then put that down onto the CPU, and that will spread it out. But honestly, I usually have a sighted person go do that with a razor blade if I have to be in charge of putting on a new CPU.
It's probably also worth mentioning that the CPU documentation will tell you which way it should go on. So if in doubt, read the documentation that comes with your CPU if it's a boxed unit, because it will have the CPU and the fan, unless it's an OEM build, and you should follow their instructions, because they obviously know what they're on about.
As I said, most CPUs already have it on for you, so you don't have to worry about it unless it's used most of the time. So to install a heatsink slash fan assembly, align the retainers with the holes on the motherboard. There are usually four, one at each corner. Place the heatsink slash fan assembly onto the CPU socket, being careful not to pinch the little wires for the CPU fan that's on top of the heatsink. Tighten the retainers to secure the assembly in place, and then connect the heatsink slash fan assembly power cable, which is the thing you didn't want to pinch, to the headers on the motherboard. These headers are usually three little pins sticking up fairly close to the CPU socket. They're pretty easy to find.
And they're evil, by the way. They're very easy to break.
Yep. We bent a couple when we were doing his assembly, and I think I got them to be correct again. I think I was able to straighten them up, but you've got to be careful doing it. They are usually keyed,
you
so
got
they
it back
will
in,
usually
but
only go
I'm not
way.
Taking it out again.
Yes. Any questions on that? Okay. So now we're going to talk about installing the RAM. Oh, Pat, go ahead.
Are the screws that connect the heatsink to the motherboard, are those screwed on the top of the board or on the bottom?
No. What you've got is this heatsink / fan assembly that comes with its own mechanism to screw on. So the heatsink has the little retaining screw type of things on it. So it's just these, on an Intel board, these things you turn and they snap into play into the little holes that they're meant to go into.
Oh, okay, I see. Thank
you. So you don't have to screw anything in. It already comes with it all. All right. Before you install RAM, check the manufacturer's website to make sure it is compatible with your motherboard. To review, RAM is temporary storage for the computer while it is on. RAM is volatile. What does that mean, anybody?
It means buy more chocolate bars.
Anyone else? Brad, go ahead.
Yeah, it just means that it, when you shut the computer off, it all the information is off of it, so it needs electricity to hold the memory in it.
Yep. Once the power is cut to the computer, everything in RAM is all gone. So that is what volatile means. And it is not me when I don't have enough chocolate. I don't eat as much chocolate as the average woman does, so yeah. So, any ideas of why we might want to install more RAM? What will RAM do for us? Pat! Brad answered the last one, so Pat gets to go.
It'll take and allow for faster processing of software. It also seems to speed up the operating system.
Yeah, it's going to enhance the performance of our computer by making things open quicker, because it will have more time to actually, or it'll have more memory to actually hold the programs. Okay, to install RAM, you want to align the notches on the RAM module to the keys in the slot and press down until the side tabs click into place, which means you're going to want to open up those side tabs before we press it in. So when you pull out RAM, that is under any 32-bit operating system. But we will talk a bit more about that and the differences between 32 and 64-bit operating systems in Module 5. Okay, so when you undo these tabs, the RAM is like a toaster. It pops up and you pull it out. So it's going to be the same kind of thing when you put in the RAM. You're going to open these two side tabs and line it up with the notch on your computer, and you're going to push down, and these two tabs are going to click into place, and your RAM will be installed. You want to feel then and make sure.
Do the tabs stick?
What?
That's okay. Do the tabs stay open long enough so that you can put the RAM in, or do you sort of have to hold the tabs
they stay
open while you press
the
RAM down?
No, the tabs stay open. The tabs only close when the RAM is seated into the.
No, they're closed.
Okay.
They're not spring loaded.
It's not like Hungry Hippo where the RAM sockets sort of go.
Reason I thought they were.
And you got to like jam it in between the time it's going.
Because in my head I was picturing that, and I thought, no wonder Grace had trouble with that. If they keep trying to like.
No.
Oh. Okay.
That's
maybe
awesome.
I'm done. Well, I'm glad it was entertainment at my expense.
Oh, everybody gets that. No, okay. The problem with RAM is that you have to line it up exactly straight, and you've got all of these little grooves that could possibly be where the RAM might want to go. And sometimes you can get half of the RAM in one groove and half of the RAM in another groove, and then it won't go in right. So you've got to make sure that you have it all in one straight line. So when it's seated,
they're very, very thin too. They're very...
Yeah, they are. This is why it has taken me 90 minutes to get a stick of RAM in the first time I did
it. They're very thin and very long. So, yeah, because I kind of say, I guess, maybe between five and eight centimeters long. But they're probably only as thick as maybe half a dozen sheets of Braille paper. And you're trying to fit this thing into this very long, very thin slot. So it's just a case of trying to get it straight. I imagine if you could see what you were doing, it'd be easy as pie. But also there's not a lot of room to feel on some boards, especially because if you've got two sticks of RAM, they're sitting right next to each other. So that can make it difficult too.
If you're only installing one stick of RAM, you've got it made. Now the second stick that's going in, if you have more than one in those bays, that's when it gets difficult. So you feel and make sure it's straight. And that those clips are holding it in, and then you're golden. Now, if you're not sure how many slots or how many notches are in your RAM, and you don't feel like you want to open up those clips and pull it out and reinstall it for any reason, what do you think you might do?
Use Bellarc Advisor.
You could do that to figure out what kind of RAM it is, and then you can go and look it up on Wikipedia or some other form of your choice.
You can also do it
under Linux with LSHW or what's the other tool? DMI decode will tell you.
You still got to figure out where to find out how many notches they have, and that was where I was having trouble. And then I remembered I had one hanging around.
It was so funny. I was sitting there. I'm like, gosh, I wish I could send you a piece of RAM to feel. And he's like, oh, I've got one sitting up on my shelf. I should just look at that.
The thing to remember is that the only one that has two is SDRAM.
Yeah. If she hadn't said, I wish I could show you some, though, I would never remember that it was in my Mac Mini's box.
Okay. Any other questions on RAM? Go ahead, Pat.
Since I took apart an old machine, the memory sticks that I saw, they were kind of thick and heavy. I've never seen thin memory.
Yours might have heat spreaders on them. Or, if they have heat spreaders, they would be quite a bit thicker.
Or they could be DIMMs. They could be SIMs if they're really old. Did they actually hinge in on a 45-degree angle and you actually pop them out with clips, or were they actually clips that swung out to the sides?
You press down on these clips, and then it came out, and to put it back in, I finally figured out you had to go to slant. So that's how it went back in, but I'm still not too sure if I want to boot that machine yet.
That's SIMs. Yeah, that's SIMs. They're actually SIMs, actually going on a 45-degree angle, and then you tip them down, and it sort of goes, and then it actually clips in. So yeah, they would have been quite thick. And in fact, some of the SDRAM is actually quite thick. One of my friends sort of says it looks a bit like double-sided blocks of chocolate. You know how the chocolate sort of split into squares, and it's sort of like, you know, look, memory chocolate. But the SDRAM and stuff tends to be quite thick and quite heavy. And then as the RAM gets newer and newer, the chips get lower and lower profile, thinner and thinner as they reduce the transistor, the circuit count and the sizes for heat dissipation and stuff. And then some of the really big fat things that are covered in metal with the little bands that wrap around the outsides are the ones with the heat spreaders, which is what Grace is talking about.
And if you can afford it, get the ones with the heat spreaders, because they're easier to install. They actually have more weight to them. They're balanced and way easier to install.
Unless they're too wide for the sockets you've got, and then you end up having to cram them in. And that's another thing I've seen as well. So you've got to be a bit careful.
So the new boards use a thinner type of memory then?
Yeah. They're very nice and thin.
It goes straight down into the socket, as Grace is saying. You open the clips, you put it straight down, you press. As you press the RAM down on each end, the clips then close and grab it, which is a lot easier than tipping them in on an angle.
Any other questions on RAM? Alright. Now it's time to install the motherboard. We use plastic and metal standoffs that go between the case and the motherboard so that it does not touch the bottom of the case. Now, why is it important that... Do you mean lifetime warranty?
Yeah, some of it does.
Yeah, a lot of RAM does. I think the Crucial memory does, and the...
King Max, Kingston... it depends. You'll pay a little bit more for lifetime warranty sometimes. So if you get A-plus cheap RAM, it may only have a 12-month warranty. But some manufacturers, I have seriously returned five-year-old sticks of RAM to companies, like King Max sticks that were 5 years old that failed, and they sent me another stick.
That is so cool.
Handy hint number 759364.8. If you have a barcode scanner, there is often a barcode on the RAM that will help you identify it. So you can slide the RAM past the scanner and beep, and yes, your ID mate will do a good job at that. And you can get the codes off and feed them into a search engine, and that will help you ID what sort of RAM you've got.
Okay, so why is it important that the motherboard does not touch the bottom of the case? Anyone? All right, Brad, have a go.
Let's keep the smoke in the machine, right? You don't want it shorting
absolutely
out.
Absolutely. You want to keep the magic smoke in the machine. You don't want it to short out. That is right. Because if there's two metal on metal touch and you boot it, oh, there we go. There's a nice short. On the other hand, we only need to use the standoffs that align with the holes on the motherboard, or it won't seat properly. So only use the ones that will go line up. Okay, go ahead, Dana. Go ahead.
I remember seeing somewhere that you normally put RAM in two sticks at a time, and generally if you're putting in bank A, you put it in C as well, and then you put B and D if you've got a full slot motherboard. Any truth to that?
That's dependent on the motherboard manual. You basically have to know what colour the banks are, and depending on the motherboard manual, you either put it in the green blanks first and then the blue blanks second or whatever. It's known as what we call dual banking, and it allows the chipset to actually access, interleave the two sticks of RAM and access it more quickly. But you don't know whether the banks are actually next to each other or whether they're separated without actually looking in the book.
I suppose then the easiest is to get RAM and put them into all four slots.
Yep, that'll do ya.
Yeah, usually you buy RAM in matched pairs though. So if you didn't have any other way of doing it, maybe you would put it in all four sockets, but sometimes you just get somebody sighted to have a look at the sockets and tell you if there's two same colour or whatever, and then, because usually you get like a kit of 2X, 2 gig sticks or whatever.
Or you could read the manual and it'll tell you, usually. Or look on a forum. Somebody will have written it out somewhere. And if you do put them in the wrong slots, it won't blow up. Alright, so the first step to installing a motherboard is to first install the standoffs in the case. Then you're going to align the I/O connectors, such as the video port, if you've got onboard video, sound, your PS2 connector, all of that, with the back of the opening in the back of the case. You're going to align the screw holes of the motherboard with the standoffs, insert all of the motherboard screws.
Handy hint. Before you actually put the motherboard in at all, which is what Grace is talking about now, make sure that the back plate for the motherboard or a compatible back plate is already installed in your case, because you cannot put the back plate in after the fact. This has had people removing the entire system board to rejig the back plane. So make sure that back plate goes in first. And often a lot of the motherboards will actually ship with a back plate that's suitable for them. Then you go onto the motherboard screws.
tighten all of the motherboard screws, and there you go, you've got the motherboard in. Now that we have, any questions on installing the motherboard? Go ahead, Pat.
What's a backplate?
Okay, the backplate is the actual bit that is on the back of the case that has the cutouts for your I.O. ports.
Oh, that's what you're talking about. Okay, I thought there was something you had to put under the motherboard.
No. The backplate is just the bit that allows you to connect up to the...
The backplate is the thing that has the I.O. bits that stick through. The base plate is the thing you actually mount the system board on the actual base plate. So back and base, two different words, just to be confusing. Yes, Dina?
Most of the cases we get here, you have little metal tabs that you can just pull out to actually... align all your cases are like that, yeah.
Okay, the cases we've got actually did come with standard backplates, but then when you actually open the system board box, there's actually a backplate for the system board that's actually got the two SP diff connectors and the HDMI connectors at the other weird connectors that just happen to be on our boards. So as the boards get newer and funkier, they often have extra connectors that aren't handled by the standard backplates, which is why I mention it.
Okay.
All right, now that we have the motherboard in place, it's time to install our internal drives. Can anyone give me some examples of internal drives? All right, Jamie, you haven't spoken. Go ahead.
Hard drive?
Absolutely. Pat, what do you think?
ROM, DVD.
ROM, yeah. And Dana?
Okay, I'll let
Let Maria go. Go ahead, Maria.
Floppy drive.
Absolutely, on the older systems. They're kind of going out of fashion now, and you won't see many more of them. They're kind of a dying breed. Which is sad and good, because now we have thumb drives.
Well, you can also put in a card reader then.
Oh, you can. Absolutely.
Four-wheel drive? Just kidding.
No, that doesn't go into a computer unless you don't want that computer anymore, and it's absolutely...
I said rushed. Hyperdrive on MSN to carry, just being dumb, so...
Oh, fair enough.
I think somebody did nickname their flash drives Hyperdrive. There is actually a company that makes Hyperdrive flash drives. But they're
I
not internal.
As fast as the... Aw.
All right. So yes, those are all internal drives. A hard drive goes into an internal 3.5-inch bay, which means that the hard drive is not accessible from the front of the case, unless you have some very fancy caddy for your drive, in which case sometimes it is. But for this, for a simple desktop, it's not accessible from the outside of the case, and that's in your test. In fact, all of these are in your test. You want to know what size of drives... go in what bays, and all of that. So hard drive, 3.5-inch internal bay. To install your hard drive, position it in 3.5-inch bay and align it with the screw holes. Insert it into the drive bay so that the screw holes and the drive line up with the screw holes in the case. And then you're going to secure it to the case using the proper screws. So what you're going to do is actually... screw it in, and you're not going to screw the screws in very tightly at first. You're going to screw it in so it has a little bit of room so that in case you didn't line up the screw holes right, you're going to have a little bit of give and can line it up right. Once you've got all four screws placed, then you can tighten them down the rest of the way. All right. Floppy drives and optical drives are installed in external bays, which means they're accessible from the front of the case so that you can insert and remove your media without opening up the case, which is what you want. An optical drive is a storage device that reads and writes information to CDs, DVDs, and Blu-rays, also known as BDs. These drives can either be POTA, using a 4-pin Molex connector for power, and a 40-pin 80-wire POTA ribbon cable for data, or SATA, And SATAs use a how many pin power connector, guys?
7. Sorry.
No. It's 15-pin power connector.
Oh.
That used to get me too.
But data is 7 pins. So you're thinking along the right track. An optical drive is installed into an external 5.25-inch bay. This is the only thing that they're going to ask you about on your test that goes into a 5.25-inch bay. So remember, optical, CDs are big, they're going to go into the 5.25-inch bay. To install your optical drive, it's basically the same type of process as you're going to do with your other drive, your hard drive. You're going to position it, align it with the bay, insert the optical drive into the bay so that the holes line up, and you also want to make sure that it lines up with the front plate and isn't indented or doesn't stick out. Then you're going to secure the optical drive to the case using the proper screws, and there you go. The final one we're going to talk
about... Should I also point out that some of these cases, like the Dell Dimension that I have, actually have rails that screw onto the drives, and then you slide the drives into the rails, which is a pain.
Yes, you can do that as well. I find that easier.
Yeah, I do too. The ones I have don't even screw, they're just...
Yeah.
I've got a case here where you gotta put in the floppy drive from the internally because the front plate is actually, it's got a cutout for the drive, but it doesn't come all the way through.
Yeah, okay. I have one of those too. You can also put media card readers in the 3.5-inch bay.
Yep. Dana had said that.
And we have a pending pet.
What would you like to say?
In previous times, I always understood that you put the burner at the very top of the case, because that was the hardest one. Is that still true in today's technology?
Depends on how your case is built. A lot of cases actually do have, they either have the power supply at the top or the power supply at the bottom. Our new ones have the power supply at the bottom. But generally the thought is that you do put the burners near the top of the case because they're generally going to be the most heat-sensitive component, and you're going to need the extraction fans on the back of the case to pull the heat away from the burner. But most burners aren't as sensitive as the old ones used to be. Probably still a good idea, though.
A lot of times I see them line up on the tower at the very top.
Most of them.
So you try to line your burner up to where most of your case fans will be pulling the heat out?
If you can. Like, if you've got a case that has, 80 mil or 120 mil fans in the back of it or whatever, try and put the burners sort of in line with those fans so that they will tend to extract the air away and keep the burner cooler, if that's possible. Otherwise, just put it in wherever. Most of them don't get as hot as they used to, although the Pioneers used to be quite sensitive to heat and would just die for no good reason if they overheated once.
Oh, that's special. Really?
Yeah, you do. Probably it's worth mentioning that the drives do go up a certain way because... There are actually some drives, Grace, you can actually mount upside down because they've actually got holding clips and you can actually mount them on the side. A lot of the CD drives you can actually mount on their side because they've got little clips that you actually clip the disc in and off it goes. But obviously, usually the connectors are closest to the bottom of the drive, like the power connectors and stuff are closest to the bottom. So, and usually the eject button, depending on how...
The eject button is below the drive, usually.
Yeah, so that's how you know which way up.
That's usually how I do it. But I didn't really even think about that. I just figured, well, you'll look and then you'll just put it in.
Also, you'll find...
Oh, the hard drive.
No, you can mount them upside down too. As long as you mount most hard drives on an exact perpendicular, you can mount them on their end, you can mount them on their side, you can mount them upside down, or you can mount them out flat. It's only if you mount them on a 30, 45 degree angle that you're likely to have trouble. Do check your drive documentation, but yep, I've run hard drives. In fact, some of the HPs mount the hard drives upside down over the top of the power supplies.
Oh.
So they're actually screwed into a holding bracket, and the screws go in from the top, and the hard drive is upside down. Yes, Mr. Thiel.
I think the quantum Quantum Bigfoots used to be like that.
No, that was
upside down.
Oh, sorry, it was Shaw. I thought it was Sean.
Yeah.
Sorry, Brian. Go ahead.
I was going to say, I have actually seen drives where hard drives where you've mounted them upside down. Some cases it works easier than others, but you can do it either way.
Yeah, there are actually screw holes in the bottom of the drive as well as in the sides. And if you look at a lot of hard drives, like internal hard drives, you'll actually find screw holes in the bottom four corners. So, yeah, it can be done. Has anyone seen those external mounting units? Sorry, we'll get to you in a second, Pat. A lot of the external mounting units where you get your, you know, 1 terabyte, you know, Dodgycom hard drive and mount it in an external case so that it becomes a 1 gig Dodgycom Time Machine backup, you'll often find that the drive will screw to a mounting plate and those screws will go in the bottom of the drive. Okay, go ahead, Pat.
Yep.
When you're mounting more than one hard drive in a case, I was reading this place where you had to, it said that you had to separate them. Is that still true?
If you can, yeah.
If you can. If you have enough room to do so, you want to. But if you don't, you don't. And you can't.
One of the things that will reduce a hard drive's life more than any other is if it is running at too hot a temperature. If you do not have sufficient cooling fans and you mount all the drives too close together, you will end up with a whole lot of data that cooks itself and you'll lose your drives and all the data on them in a short amount of time. So, however, you know, it depends on the drives. If they're 7200 RPM drives and they're going to sweat out a lot of heat, then you definitely would like to separate them. If they're 5400 green drives, it's less of a problem, but you do need to grab a copy of SmartMont Tools or whatever and check your drive temperatures. And if your drives are running at 50 degrees centigrade,
oh, then you're make
sure you've got backups of whatever's on them.
You can get hard drive cooling units as well.
Yeah, I got one of those once. Go ahead.
I would think if you had the hard drives, if you had multiple hard drives too close together, the vibrations would between them would be a problem, wouldn't it be?
No, the heat's the worst of the problem.
I know, but that would be a minor problem, I think, with that arrangement as well.
No, usually you tighten up the screws and they don't vibrate as much. And because they all run at about the same speed, it's not as if they're sort of going to go, wow, wow, wow. They're pretty good. Those hard drive cooling units are good. Just be careful, though. Make sure you get the ones with the ball bearing fans or reasonable fans, because otherwise you're going to get the wobbles of death, and that will be the end of them.
Where do they go?
They go around the hard drive. Like, the hard drive actually slides into them, and then you mount the hard drive into a 5.25-inch bay. I've got a Cooler Master bay that you can actually mount 4 hard drives into 3 5.25-inch bays, and they all mount into this sort of big frame with a 80mm fan on the back.
Oh, okay.
That's kind of cool.
So it replaces the bays in your case. Gotcha.
They can. I think there are other ones that don't as much, but I haven't ever bothered with getting hard drive cooling units, because I only have one at most, 2 in my drives, in my computers.
That sounds just like these external enclosure sort of designs.
Yeah, but it's internal. So, yeah. I like that, though. Yeah. Alright. A floppy disk drive is a storage device that reads and writes information to a floppy disk. These use a 4-pin Berg connector for power. And how many pins does a floppy drive data cable have, anybody?
34. Oops.
Not you.
Yeah, that's right. That's 34,
that's
yeah.
That's what you were going to say, wasn't it?
Absolutely.
What did you want to say, Dana?
No, I was going to actually say it's a 40-pin 80 strand cable.
No, it isn't.
Sorry, 34.
Yeah, the potters are the
40-pin 80 wire. A floppy drive.
I'm not sure where my brain is today.
That's okay. A floppy drive is installed in a 3.5-inch external bay. To install a floppy drive, position the drive so that it is aligned with the 3.5-inch drive bay. insert the FDD into the drive bay so that the FDD screw holes align with the screw holes in the case. Secure the FDD to the case using the proper screws. Any questions on that or installing drives? No, is everybody awake?
Yep.
I'm awake.
I was finding out about why one of our friends had to forcibly remove someone from their house, so I wasn't paying attention.
Really?
Yeah. I'll tell you when I've got details.
I just asked if anyone was awake.
Well, Dane is awake. And Brad's awake. And
Pat's awake.
I'm awake too.
Yay, if I'm not awake, this is the most educational dream I've ever had.
Dane's awake.
You have to ask Ellie about
Dane
those.
Is a dream.
I shall just reboot her computer remotely now. Oh.
If you make me lose my notes, I will cry.
I wouldn't do that.
I am sleeping.
I know. I'm just saying.
We know. Cool. Alright, we are now going to talk about installing. Kylie needed me to do something and forgot I was in lecture. Good times. I'll get back to her as soon as I'm done with lecture. Alright, we are going to talk about cards. So, there are all sorts of adapter cards. What kind of adapter cards might we stick in to enhance our computers, guys? All right, Maria and Jamie. Maria first, Jamie next. So go ahead and name one.
Graphics card.
Absolutely. Jamie?
Network card.
Absolutely. Any other ideas, guys? Aiden?
Video capture, TV tuner, sound card.
Ah, going for extra brownie points. Yes, that's right. Okay. So...
just in case someone has one of those old wedding videos.
the old wedding video on VHS. I'd like it on a DVD disc player, if you don't mind.
I actually had somebody ask me to if I could copy their country cassettes onto compact disc. Sadly, I declined.
$50 an hour.
I have had people pay me that, Drew, for tape restoration.
That's fair.
Stuff.
No, I'm serious. Yeah, that's what you. Oh, what's the adapter card that allows your computer to be really great at answering questions on Jeopardy?
Would that be the Watson card?
I think
Which is very ironic. It should be the Sherlock Holmes card, but whatever.
Yes, and Sherlock Holmes never said "Elementary, my dear Watson." Let's move
he
on.
He didn't. No, because Watson would always ask the questions and Holmes had the answers. That was why they worked so well.
That's right.
Oh, makes sense. Okay.
Okay, so our NICs or any cards use either PCI or PCI Express or PCIe expansion slots on the motherboard. So we're going to go through installing one of these cards. We're going to align the NIC to the appropriate expansion slot on the motherboard, press down gently on the NIC until the card is fully seated. You'll be able to feel it go into the slot. And you're going to secure it to the mounting bracket of the case with a screw. These usually only need one screw. Alright. You can do the same with a wireless NIC, except you will possibly need to screw the antenna onto the back of the NIC card. Now, don't be surprised with a wireless NIC card. If you have it slammed up against a wall, that the signal won't get through to actually give you a wireless signal, because the antenna has to go through the wall and the computer case to get its signal there, so your signal is going to be pretty degraded. And just keep that in mind when you're doing wireless NICs on a desktop. Does that make any sense? Go ahead, Brad.
Yeah, I got a question on the card slots, because I'm looking at this actually the cage to the Optiplex thing that I got. I'm tearing apart here. They got the really wide slots, and then there's the narrower one. You know, they're not so long. Which ones are which?
Okay, so. Is this an older one, or?
Yeah, this is an Optiplex, GX1. It's like from the late 90s, probably, or whatever. But I don't know if this is the original.
Okay, so what you've got...
Handy hint, and we will cover this, but handy hint, there are actually some hardware description files up on the website, which will actually explain the difference between the ISAR, the PCI, the AGP, and we didn't have PCI Express. But anyway, go ahead, Grace.
Okay, so in the 90s, late 90s, you probably have a bunch of cards that are all stuck together and are all the same length. Those are your PCI cards. Then you're going to have one card set back about an inch off. That is going to be an AGP slot. The rest of them I have not actually seen on an older computer, so I really can't tell you because I've had experience with computers from the late 90s and basically onwards. I've
the
seen
ISA
an ISA
ones.
Card, but I don't remember them anymore.
The ISA slots are separated. They've got about a quarter-inch square gap in the center of the socket, and the slot is actually split in half, and it feels as though you've got like little metal fingers that would actually grab on each side of the slot. It's sort of like a almost like a Centronics connector, a female Centronics connector on acid.
Yeah, these...
I've still
this
got
one
some
has
of cards lying around here.
Wow.
Yeah, this one has about 4 of the... Well, actually, there's like 3 of them. 4 of them in a row. 3 of them in a row. Then there's a short one. Then there's another long one. Then there's 3 short ones. But I do see what you're talking about, the space between them. Maybe these could be ice, I suppose, too. But yeah, I was just curious. I'll go up there and see if I can look at the audio descriptions on it. It'd be good.
You'll have PCI Express cards now that will be of different lengths. Your PCI Express 1 card will be the shortest, then 4, then 8, and then 16, I believe it is. And 16 is your longest. That is the slot you're going to put your new video cards into. And then you'll have a whole bunch of PCI Express cards. PCI slots that you can stick things into as well. And they'll be all together and about all the same length. Any other questions on that? Good. Alright, cool. And if you don't have questions, and I ask if you don't, if a bunch of you can just type no into chat, that would be great. Then I won't pause for you, and we'll just keep moving. All right. After all components are installed, it's time to connect our internal cables. These include case leads, which operate the power button and the LED lights, power cables, and data cables. The motherboard has power cables, just like every other component, or else how would we get power to it? An ATX motherboard has either a 20 or 24-pin power socket, and can have 4 or 6 pin I think it's 4 or 8 pin auxiliaries, isn't it? Okay.
Yeah, it's 4 or 8 pin auxiliaries, and I've actually discovered one of our students actually managed to plug in next to the CPU, they actually plugged in one of the 8 pin connectors into the 2 4 pins that were next to each other, and the power supply shut down, and he went, ooh, that's not what's supposed to plug in there, and he went and plugged the correct cables in. That happened last week, so careful about that.
Fantastic. Who did that? You'll have to tell me when that happened.
I've done more horrifying things than...
Yeah, you've blown CPUs. All right. Now, on the test, they're going to ask you about these auxiliary connectors. They're spelled AUX. That is not how JAWS pronounces them. So have a look at the test question and make sure you find AUX. Because you will get that wrong if you don't have a really good look. All right. A 20-pin connector can be used with a 24-pin socket. It's just not going to get as much power. These are large rectangle connectors, and they have 2 rows of pins. And you can actually tactily count these fairly easily. So if you're doing your assembly, disassembly, you can run your fingers along and count these by touch, which is not something you can easily do with many of the connectors. To connect them, line up the ATX power connector with the socket on the motherboard and gently press down the connector until you hear the clip click into place. These are keyed. You cannot easily put them in the wrong way unless you really push. Then you're going to line up your AUX connector to the socket on the motherboard and gently press it down on the connector until the clip clicks into place. All right. Any questions on that? Cool. All right. So who was paying attention? SATA power connector. How many pins?
15.
Said 15, you're right. Sorry, Brad. They're used to connect any SATA device. What can be SATA devices, guys? All right, Maria? Any other ideas of what can be a SATA device, Maria, besides hard drives? There are others.
Externals? But
no,
yeah,
those would be eSATAs. Jamie?
CD-ROM drive?
Absolutely. CD, DVD-ROM, BD, any optical drive can be SATA. So your hard drives and your optical drives can be SATA. These connectors, SATA connectors, can sometimes be on the same circuit board, or like Luke and I, who were sitting there trying to work out his external hard drive, they were on the same socket board, but two different connectors. You pulled off the end of it because we could not figure out how to get this SATA, this drive, you know, to come apart. And all you did was simply pull off the end, and there were the connectors. And gosh, I felt stupid after it took me a half an hour to figure that out, guys, especially because I'd seen drives like that before. It was really good. Molex connectors have how many pins and connect what type of devices? Come on, nobody knows? Jamie, have a go.
I'm taking hard drives and 4 pins.
4 pins, and they will connect PATA devices, including hard drives and optical drives that have PATA connections. Molex equals PATA. Some drives have both types of connectors. Do not use both at the same time. Choose one or the other. You're either going to use the SATA data and power or the PATA data and power, depending on the what you want to do and
PATA
how many,
power.
PATA
even.
Power. Yeah, sorry. Depending on what you've got in your motherboard, don't plug in both. All right. How many pins does the Berg connector have, and what device does it provide power to? Go ahead.
34 pins, and it provides power to the floppy drive.
Incorrect, sort of. The Berg connector is a... Go ahead, Rich.
It's a 4-pin connector, and it connects the floppy drive.
Yes, it is a 4-pin connector. The data cable is 34 pins.
Oh, right, of course, yeah.
I will drill these into your head. These are important in case you are sitting A+, and for this quiz. You won't have many of these types of questions on the final, but for this quiz, it's important, and if you're doing A+, these are things you want to know. All right. So, you're going to plug the SATA power connector into the hard drive, plug the Molex power connector into the optical drive, plug the 4-pin Berg connector into the floppy disk drive, connect the 3-pin fan power connector into the appropriate fan header on the motherboard, which we've already done. Plug in any additional cables from the case into the appropriate connectors according to the motherboard manual. Now, those little leads, that is going to be something you'll have a sighted person do, or you can do trial and error if you really feel brave and have nobody to do it for you. I just try and find somebody and buy them a beverage of their choice if they'll hook up those case leads, because that is quite helpful. Any questions on power cables? Do we all have those fairly straight?
Um, I think the major problem is the actual case leads that leads for the LEDs, yeah. And the and the USB ports and so on.
Yep, they're little, they're fiddly, and they're horrible. So try and get someone else to do those for you. Do I have that?
I was curious to know if Kerry has any idea around that.
He says he has somebody, somebody who will try to plug them in and find the two that short out to do up the power button. Other than that, dude, we just get someone to do it because we really, that's not something that is very easily done at all. He's away right now, but you can ask him again, but he'll say that to you, basically.
Yeah, I probably had more trouble with that, hooking up the buttons, than I did with seeding the process.
Yeah, I think one of the major problems, I've got cases here with the cables are all the same color, so you don't even know which goes where.
Oh, fantastic. You can read the motherboard manual, and it'll give you some ideas. Pat, what did you want to say?
Could you short out your the motherboard or anything out by doing trial and error?
I don't believe so, but ask Kerry when he comes back. I don't think Chris would have done it if that was a danger. Go ahead, Brad.
It's
Conrad, go ahead. Sorry.
Yeah. I noticed that the power cables have, or at least the ones I have seen, have us ridge on one side. Is that normal?
Yeah. With the little thing, that's keyed so you can put the actual cable in the correct way. I believe that's what you're speaking about. Or are you speaking about something else?
I'm not sure. I know it has a ridge on one side.
Okay. Yeah, I think that's a key. Yeah, that's for the keying. It's a keying notch. Kerry, is there any danger in doing trial and error? Can you short out the motherboard if you're doing trial and error with the LED leads and everything? I said I didn't think so. No, there isn't. Dane also wants to know if you have any suggestions on how to do that independently.
You don't.
You do.
You get a screwdriver and you short down across every pin until you find the power lead, and then you plug the power lead in it and forget about the rest. Unless you want to be bothered with a talking multimeter and figuring out, you'll never know which one's the case light and which one's the hard drive light, though. So it can be a little bit challenging.
What about the USB ones?
USBs are keyed, so you plug those in, and there's a pin missing out of the 10-pin connector that stops you from putting it in back around the wrong way.
Yeah, there's 86 million little spiky bits that you could possibly plug the thing into.
Yeah, the only thing here is the USB cables that I've got actually are all individual little pins that actually slot into the actual header.
That's the ASUS thing where you've got you've got all these little pins and you plug it into the little
block
and then you plug the block into the system board. That wouldn't be something I'd be doing myself unless there was no other way.
Okay, I'll use a pair of eyes for this one.
Yeah, I do. I would. That's not something I do on my own. That is quite difficult. And you only have to have it done once. You're not going to take those out again. Go ahead, Pat.
Recently, I added a card reader to an older machine, and I found that you can buy USB cards that have headers on them. And that's how I get my headers on my USB disk.
Yeah, that does. That will work. You can have USB ports plugged in by a PCI card. I have one of those in one of my computers that I built.
You can get FireWire PCI cards, too.
All right. The next bit we're going to talk about, are we good with internal cable, with the internal power cables? We're next going to talk about data cables. These run from the device to the motherboard rather than from the device to the power supply. The PODA cable is a flat, wide ribbon cable, and unless it is one of those fancy ones that's all curled up and you get a nice fancy little tube with a ribbon cable inside of it. And this has 80 wires and 40 pins. A PODA cable has three connectors, one for the motherboard and two for the drives. If you're running cable select, you want to plug in the right correct colored end to the correct end of the motherboard or the hard drive or optical drive. Otherwise, you can plug in either end. If you plug them in wrong, it's not going to kill you. This is not going to be a big deal at all. If the hard drive isn't detected, you turn it around, and there you go. The drive on the end of the cable is usually the master drive. The drive in the middle of the connector, if you've got two drives on a PODA connection, is usually the slave drive. If the keying on one end is different to another end, you will try to plug it in to, if it doesn't work on the hard drive, try and plug it into the motherboard, and you might just have some luck. Also, if two of the connectors are closer together, which they're on some cables, that means they are the ones for the drives. To install it, you're going to line up the keying notches, because these will only go in one way unless they are super old. And I have seen one cable that was super old, and I did put it in the wrong way. I was very lucky that I had also not pushed the main power connector in hard enough to power it up, or I would have let the smoke out of that computer. And it was a college lab computer that I was working on for a hardware class, but it would have still been so embarrassing. Pin 1 is usually on the side towards the power connector of the drive. Alright, so you're just going to plug those in, and they go in easily. You just have to make sure you line them up, push them in, and there you go. Any questions on PODA data connectors? Cool. Alright, the SATA drive has... the data cable has 7 pins and connects to the SATA devices. You just plug these in. Doesn't matter which end, they're much easier to deal with because you can only... Hard drive should always be the master. CD drive should be the slave.
There are some hard drives, however, that have a different settings for single master only. So, for example, the Western Digital's default to having a jumper set across neutral pins 4 and 6, and a master drive with slave present. So you must change the jumpering on a Western Digital to make it master with slave present if you're going to slave something to it, otherwise you'll get weird timeouts.
Floppy data cables are thin ribbon cables with 34 wires. There's a twist in the end where the A drive is plugged in. Remember this because it's in your test. The A drive goes on the end, and the middle connector is for an additional drive B, if desired. Not many people do this. Motherboards have one floppy drive connector, if they have one at all. These connectors are usually keyed. If you plug in the drive wrong way around, the drive activity light will stay lit. And if it... Really?
Well, they usually turn up with a system board unless you've got a really new system board that just doesn't have it. But yeah, most system boards have a floppy cable with the system board stuff.
The floppy drive that I have... cable that I have now is not keyed at all.
Oh, some of them aren't keyed.
Some of them aren't, but most of the newest ones are. If it goes in the wrong way, the track zero of the disk will be removed and you won't be able to access the data anymore on it. But it's not going to blow up. You just turn the floppy drive connector around and it's okay. You're not going to blow anything up. The activity light's just going to be on. The drive isn't going to work. And you just spin it around and it's not a big deal.
How would you visually identify it?
Visually identify
which? I mean, the right way to turn it around. The right way to
turn it. You just turn it around. There's always pin ones. Oh, okay. There would be a stripe on the cable that you would be able to see, if you could see, that would indicate which way the cable would go. Otherwise, it should be keyed. If it isn't, try it one way. If it doesn't work, try it the other way. When all internal cables are connected, you can put the panels back on the case and plug in the external cable. Make sure to secure the case with all of the correct screws. If you are unsure how to close your case up, consult its documentation. Then it would be time to plug in your external cables. What type of external cables might we plug in? Go ahead, Pat. And then
cable to the printer.
What do you think, Jamie?
PS2 cables.
Absolutely. Go ahead, Brian.
Your power, to your cable to your power supply.
Absolutely, that's important. Maria, go ahead.
Your monitor cables.
Yep, monitor cables, keyboard, USB, all those cables are going to be plugged in.
If you're blind, your sound card cables.
Oh, yes, absolutely. Headphones or your braille display. Ethernet.
Be careful. I've seen a really weird type of setup where, speaking of cables, because I had to access a computer and the college computers usually had their sound cards way at the back where no one could get to them, they actually installed this thing that plugged into a port in the back somewhere, I think even a serial port, I'm not sure, and then they had one of those data plates that I think was in a 3.5 bay in the front, so I guess it somehow hooked into the sound card, and it never mind, it was in the headphone and mic jack and the sound card in the back, and then it basically made the thing come out the front, but it was actually used up a port in the back. I thought that was kind of interesting.
Odd.
I've actually seen those speakers that go in a 5.25-inch bay, and they've actually got little speakers and headphone jacks and a volume control and stuff on the front panel. It's another way of doing it.
Do they sound like crap?
No, they sounded really good, surprisingly, because they're actually...
One of those.
Oh, cool.
Yeah, they're 5.25-inch bay, so you're not looking at tiny little speakers. They're actually fairly reasonable speakers, and they actually looked as though they had little slanty eyes
on
them.
That's kind of cool.
Yeah.
That would be cool, yeah. I've never seen that.
Yeah,
this one, I feel things
going
around the back.
You can actually slide the
speaker around. Cool.
You can actually move the speaker.
Right on.
Yeah, these popped out of the headphone jack and into like a US into a serial port of some kind, and then the plate was on the front of the computer. It was kind of weird.
Oh, okay. Be careful to connect all cables to the proper place. For example, the mouse and keyboard cables can be mixed up. If you can feel with your fingers, there are little icons on many of these, and you'll be able to tell. Otherwise, if it's your computer, you can use your tongue. Otherwise, trial and error, everybody. That's not going to blow up either. If you're really worried, use a USB keyboard. If it does... Go ahead, Pat.
Is it that those PS2 ports, aren't they pretty standard, like keyboard first and then mouse? So I always say K before M?
No, I've actually had four cases where they were the other way around to what you'd expect. If you're lucky, they will be usually the keyboard is closest to the power supply or closest to the edge of the case, and then the mouse is further in. Usually, if you get them wrong and power them up, the keyboard and the mouse won't work, whereupon you turn it off and switch them over. But I have actually seen them in the reverse order. It was really odd. Admittedly, it was an HP, but it actually had them round the other way.
If it doesn't fit, don't force it. Turn it around the other way. Be gentle. Try not to bend the pins on the serial port or the monitor connectors. Plug in the power cable last. That is the advice of Cisco, plug it in last, right before you turn it on. And
there's a reason for that.
Yeah, because if that switch isn't flipped, it might turn on, and you don't want that.
Yeah, actually, sometimes as soon as you plug the power cord into some boards, if they're set to come back to on state when power returns, then they will power up straight away.
Go ahead, Brian.
I actually, on the desktop, I think I'm starting to lose my voice, but anyway, on the desktop that I've got, that I use in my Linux box, if you plug the power in, it'll actually turn on for like 30 seconds and then turn back off.
Oh, I've seen that.
That's kind of an interesting thing. It's the first one I've ever seen do it.
Yeah, I've seen that happen too with a Dell I had.
My Dell did it when the power cut off. When it came back on, the fan would kind of start up and it was like, oh, I should come on now. No, I'll turn off.
Oh, it's annoying and you're like, oh my gosh, there's something really wrong with my computer. And then you turn it on and it works fine. All right. Once we have all our stuff plugged in, now it's time to cross our fingers, say a prayer, and boot the computer for the first time. When the computer is booted, the basic input-output system, or BIOS, performs a check on all of the internal components. POST checks to see if all of the hardware in the computer is operating correctly. If a device is malfunctioning, an error or beep code alert tells the technician that there is a problem. Yep, power on self-test. Typically, a single beep denotes that the computer is functioning properly. As long as you have a computer speaker plugged in, you will hear this. If you don't, you won't hear anything. If there is a hardware problem...
A lot of computers don't beep anymore, which saddens me greatly.
Yeah. If there is a hardware problem, a series of beeps...
None of the boxes I've got has got speakers anyway.
I don't know that ours does.
Yeah, but we don't have the little speakers to plug into them, because they actually have to have a little speaker that goes inside. I always love the way the self-satisfied way Macs go, bah! When you turn them on, as if to go, I'm using a Mac, but there is actually a program called PSST, which will let you patch the BIOS and stop that horrendous thing from happening.
If there's a hardware problem, the computer might emit a series of beeps. Each BIOS manufacturer uses different beep codes to indicate hardware problems. For a list of beep codes for you,
mine did that.
The documentation of the motherboard. It would have. Or have a look on the web. There's a table listing some sample beep codes in the curriculum as well. All right. Next week we will finish up with this chapter. We only have a little bit to go. I'll give you guys a quick quiz, and we will start with Module 4. Questions? Okay, you guys, you can wake up now. Lecture's over.